Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Robert Herbst, a civil rights attorney in New York, who examines the International Court of Justice interim ruling in South Africa's case accusing Israel of committing genocide in its catastrophic war in Gaza. Nika Jones-Tapia, of the group Chicago Beyond and former warden of Chicago's Cook County Jail, who talks about her experience fighting to reform policies that lead to mass incarceration. And Pablo Priluca, a doctoral candidate at Princeton University, who assesses Argentina's newly elected radical right-wing president Javier Milei's shock therapy economic policies and gathering resistance to his program. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a sign of supreme irony, Sudan rebel leader Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo visited the genocide memorial in Rwanda. Dagalo, who leads the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF militia group in Sudan, is accused of mass atrocities in Darfur and currently controls the capital city of Khartoum and the second-largest city, Wad Madani. His troops have killed thousands of civilians, seized property, plundered aid, robbed banks, and used rape as a weapon of war. Since Sudan's civil war broke out in April, over 7 million people have fled their homes and nearly 2 million have become refugees. The RSF militia has been accused of genocide in Darfur, the same area where atrocities were committed by Dagalo's fighters 20 years ago. With his military victories in Sudan, Dagalo has been warmly received in African capitals in nations including South Africa, Uganda, Djibouti, Kenya, and Ethiopia. The United Arab Emirates has been a major supplier of weapons to Dagalo's RSF. And because many African countries want to strengthen ties with the UAE, which is flush with petrodollars, they've been eager to embrace Dagalo and the RSF, despite its many atrocities. The Guardian reports that new research finds there's resounding evidence showing that high corporate profits in the U.S. are a main driver of ongoing inflation in consumer prices, and companies continue to keep prices high even as their inflationary costs drop. The report, compiled by the progressive think tank Groundwork Collaborative, found corporate profits accounted for about 53% of inflation during last year's second and third quarters. However, according to the report, profits drove only 11% of price growth in the 40 years prior to the COVID pandemic. Groundwork's strategic advisor, Liz Pancotti, maintains that costs have come down substantially. While corporations are quick to pass on incremental costs to consumers, they are less quick to pass along their savings. She went on to say, "We need to take a really hard look at how our tax code incentivizes corporate profiteering and ask, do we as a country want to do something about that?" Thermal energy networks, also known as networked geothermal, scale up the energy transition away from fossil fuels. The networks are a series of water pipes that rely on heat collected from narrow shafts known as boreholes, dug hundreds of feet into the ground, where the ambient temperature remains a relatively stable 55 degrees. Their innovation, however, lies in linking together the heating and cooling systems of nearby buildings, efficiently transitioning them to green energy. In These Times magazine reports that across New York State, trade unions, environmentalists, and power companies are embracing new thermal energy network technology as a viable path forward to phase out natural gas and make the transition to renewable energy required under New York State's 2019 landmark Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. Brett Thomason, political director of Steamfitters Union Local 638, has seen how power plant closures have often left his members unemployed. Thomason, now a booster of new thermal energy network systems, said, "Not only will this new technology keep our members employed, but it's an opportunity to build out a workforce based on clean energy." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
History was made on January 26th when the International Court of Justice issued an interim ruling on South Africa's charge that Israel had violated the Genocide Convention in its war on Gaza that has thus far killed more than 26,000 Palestinians, destroyed most of the territory's civilian infrastructure, and displaced 75% of Gaza's 2.3 million residents. This is only the fourth time that a country has brought a genocide case before the court. In its ruling, the ICJ declared it had jurisdiction to rule in the case, rejecting Israel's call for the charge to be thrown out, although the justices did not order a ceasefire that South Africa had demanded. The court ordered six provisional measures, including for Israel to take action to prevent genocidal acts, prevent and punish the direct and public incitement to genocide, and take immediate and effective steps to ensure the provision of humanitarian assistance to civilians in Gaza. On the same day as the ICJ issued its ruling, Israel publicly alleged that 13 employees of the United Nations' main relief agency in Gaza, UNRWA, were associated with Hamas's October 7th terrorist attack on Israel that killed 1,200 Israelis and captured 240 hostages. In response, UNRWA fired those employees, and the U.S. and some of its allies suspended funding to the agency. Your reporter spoke with Robert Herbst, a civil rights lawyer in New York, who served as a federal prosecutor in Chicago and Philadelphia. Attorney Herbst is co-chair of the U.S. chapter of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, a former coordinator of the Westchester, New York chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace, and served as an independent investigator and prosecutor for the International Criminal Tribunals for Rwanda and Sierra Leone. Here he looks at the ICJ's interim ruling and considers how the court's orders could be enforced.
Israel was ordered to take all measures to ensure that acts deemed genocidal under the Genocide Convention do not take place in Gaza. Secondly, to ensure that its military, the Israeli military, does not commit genocidal acts. Third, to prevent and punish incitement to genocide. Fourth, to enable and facilitate the provision of basic services and humanitarian assistance to the people of Gaza. Fifth, prevent destruction of and preserve evidence of genocide in its military operations. And last but not least, to report to the court within 1 month about its compliance with the first five provisional measures. It is a historic ruling by the United Nations' highest court. As a result of it, all state parties to the Genocide Convention, including Israel and the United States, now have a binding legal obligation to make sure that any genocidal acts come to an immediate halt. It is a huge moment for the International Court of Justice and a huge victory for the rule of law. It could have gone the other way. It didn't.
Robert, what do you make of Israel and the U.S. response to the International Court of Justice ruling here? Previously, the Biden administration has said that the case was meritless and without any factual basis. And of course, as you'd expect, Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel has basically claimed the court's ruling was outrageous and rejects all the provisions that were made in the finding of the court.
Well, I think we got to watch what Biden and Netanyahu and the United States and Israel does, not so much what they say. Because I think this is a huge political and public relations defeat for Israel, which now stands in the international dock of shame. the world's highest court, having found that it's credibly been accused of genocide. And look what is happening. The New York Times reported that the party seemed to be closing in on a deal for a two-month truce, a full cessation of hostilities, which would not just permit the joint release of hostages and political prisoners from both Gaza and Israel, but it would permit the aid to come in. And there is, the Times reported, an anticipation or an expectation that the two-month cessation of hostilities be extended and become essentially permanent. Now, I don't know if that deal will go through, but the fact that knowledgeable people are reporting that in the wake of the court's decision, the deal is close, I think is a better indication of the impact of the court's decision than what the parties are saying. And in fact, Algeria, which is a non-permanent member of the Security Council, you know, they serve two-year terms if you're not a permanent member, has exercised its right to call for a meeting of the Security Council to discuss how to enforce the provisional measures that the court has imposed on Israel. And I think, you know, that's keeping the pressure on Israel and the United States. And it raises the question whether the U.S. is going to veto a Security Council resolution designed to enforce the provisional measures of the world's highest court. It may. The United States may do it. But I'm not fully convinced that Biden will feel comfortable going down in history as the U.S. president who defied a court order from the highest court in the world and permitted genocide to continue. You know, it's hard to say, but I think the decision is having an important impact. And I will just add that on the same day it was issued, it was cited by the federal judge in California hearing the case against Biden, Blinken, and Austin for facilitating and being complicit in Israel's genocide. He held a three-hour hearing, and he ended it by saying it's the most difficult decision he has to make in 20 years on the bench. So, again, no one knows how it's going to come out. But the fact that he cited the International Court of Justice's decision and seemed to give it significant weight, I think is an indication that this is not just a hill of beans or, you know, the paper that it's printed on, but that it's a very, very meaningful event.
That was Robert Herbst, a civil rights attorney in New York, who served as an independent investigator and prosecutor for the International Criminal Tribunals for Rwanda in Sierra Leone. Find more analysis and commentary on the ICJ's ruling on Israel by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The United States incarcerates by far the most people of any nation in the world per capita. About 2.1 million individuals are currently held in the nation's jails and prisons. Many are there pre-trial. That is, they have not yet been convicted of a crime. A large percentage of those incarcerated in the U.S. suffer from mental illness. There have been several attempts in recent years to reduce the prison population, including during the COVID pandemic, when some elderly prisoners and those with health issues were granted early release to home confinement. Chicago Beyond is a philanthropic organization launched in 2016 to fight against the inequities pervasive in Chicago's communities. The group invests in community-led initiatives and individuals who are fighting for all youth to achieve their fullest human potential in Chicago and beyond. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Nika Jones-Tapia, Managing Director of Justice Initiatives at Chicago Beyond, where she works as a clinical psychologist and is a former warden of Chicago's Cook County Jail. Here she explains her unique approach to reducing mass incarceration from inside the system.
Criminal justice reform is a top priority for us. And our goal in our work is to influence systems change in carceral facilities. And I think a lot of that is due to my history working in corrections. We have close proximity and a deeper understanding as to how systems can make change. And we couple our team expertise with the expertise and wisdom of people who have worked in the system and people who have been confined in the system. And that's really a different approach. I think many times historically and currently, you know, we will have organizations that do incredible work to shift what's happening in carceral facilities, but rarely do they bring two sides together who are oftentimes at odds with each other, correctional staff and people incarcerated, bringing those two groups together to really push change further and faster.
So maybe you could just say a little bit about your previous work within the criminal justice system or injustice system.
I worked in corrections for about 11 and a half years, and most of that tenure was spent at the Cook County Jail in Chicago. When I first started working at the Cook County Jail, there were about 10,000 people housed there. I had many roles there. One of them was as clinical psychologist. I helped to revamp the system's mental health services from intake into the facility through discharge. And then I retired in 2018 from corrections after being the warden of that facility for about 3 years. And during my tenure as warden, was able to see some incredible shifts happen in the system, one of them being a population drop. So we worked with criminal justice system stakeholders from across the county, and during my tenure was able to see about a 20% drop in the people who were housed in that institution. And that drop has continued and even increased with bail reform. We also implemented a number of initiatives and reforms, all meant to better support the people who were incarcerated in the system, as well as the staff. And so once I joined Chicago Beyond in 2018, it was really an opportunity for me to take the learnings from that experience that I had in corrections and really lean into the possibility for change that could occur with people who had been incarcerated in the system and with staff. Because coming out of that system, I understood that all of us, correctional administrators, correctional staff, people who were incarcerated in the system, all of us were negatively impacted by the toxicity that existed within that system. And that is the case for every correctional system in this country.
Could you just give an example maybe of the work that you did that led to the reduction, the 20% reduction? How did that come about?
What really started with us being more transparent about who was in the system. Because community, larger society is oftentimes cut off from what happens behind those carceral walls, it was important for us to share with people that there were many people who were incarcerated in the system whom we felt should not be there. People with serious mental illness, people who had committed some crime to eat, people who were charged with crimes that were really crimes of survival. And I think it was that narrative that really sparked a shift in the whole Cook County criminal justice system to recognize that we were doing something wrong. So that it was really the public, I think, that had an outcry and called for change. And a lot of other justice system stakeholders understood what was happening and understood that the people that were being placed in the system really wasn't equating to safer communities. In fact, it was making us less safe. And so thankfully, you know, the criminal justice system stakeholders came together, and it was through collaborations with all of the system stakeholders that we were able to coordinate a shift in how bail was formed here. And judges made changes to who they were placing in the system, I think in large part due to an understanding that a lot of people had been placed there in years prior that didn't belong there.
That was Dr. Nika Jones-Tapia, Managing Director of Justice Initiatives at Chicago Beyond. Learn more about the group's work, challenging policies that lead to mass incarceration, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When Argentina's voters went to the polls to elect a new president on November 19th last year, their nation was in the midst of a severe economic crisis, with inflation raging at the time at more than 140%, rising poverty, and $43 billion in external debt owed to the IMF, and $65 billion owed to bondholders. Sergio Massa, the centrist candidate of the governing Peronist coalition, lost the election to Javier Milei, a self-described anarcho-capitalist who pledged to implement a radical austerity program that he claimed would fix the economy. Since taking office on December 10th, Milei, a former TV personality who downplayed the atrocities of Argentina's brutal military dictatorship, issued a presidential decree with 300 measures that slashed funding to dozens of government programs, deregulated the economy, overturned laws protecting workers and their rights to strike, privatized state-owned companies, and threatened to use the military to repress opposition protests. In office just 7 weeks, Milei has presided over an economy where inflation continues to rise over 200%, with skyrocketing food, fuel, and drug prices hitting Argentina's poor the hardest. Responding to Milei's shock therapy austerity program, Argentina's labor unions organized a massive 12-hour general strike on January 24th that brought parts of downtown Buenos Aires to a standstill. Your reporter spoke with Pablo Priluca, a doctoral candidate in the Department of History at Princeton University, who assesses Milei's radical right economic policies and the mobilizing of resistance, where many opponents call the new president a traitor.
I do think that there's probably a 10 or 20% of his electorate who are totally convinced that, you know, and the central bank should be, you know, dismantled. The welfare state is the main problem of Argentina. Immigration is bad. Abortion is it's a crime. I mean, there is a strong core that are identified with his main ideas, but also there is a bunch of people who are just desperate, who are living under poverty, especially young people who didn't see, you know, a perspective of upward social mobility, who didn't see the chance of getting their own house or getting a car or, you know, have savings and improve their living conditions. And after, you know, years and years of choosing different and rational governments, I mean, no matter the political sign of them, more traditional governments, now they went for the outsider. And in a way, even if it's terrible and it's scary, it makes sense.
Right.
I wouldn't blame them.
Pablo, I did want to ask you about Milei's program. Please summarize for our audience Milei's government's actions since he took office regarding issuing a decree with 300 edicts to repeal laws, eliminate dozens of state regulations, enabling the privatization of state companies, and his threat to use armed force to repress protesters.
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack here. I would say there is like one Milei, the Milei during the campaign for the run for the presidency, who had like one program and a set of ideas. And then there is the Milei in power, who is in a way learning that democracy implies bargaining and negotiations and you know, political exchanges or whatever with other political forces, especially in the Congress. He hasn't accomplished much yet. You know, you mentioned the decree, you mentioned the elimination of state regulations and the privatization of state companies. Yes, he wants to privatize the few state companies that we still have. Why do I say the few? Because Argentina had the first wave of privatizations during the early 90s, so there are not much left to privatize, right? The main one, and I think is the one that we should definitely stop him from doing it, is the oil company, the petroleum company, that he has already given up in the middle of the negotiations in the Congress. So that apparently it's not happening right now. He's trying to deregulate the unionization of workers, which is a huge thing for Argentina. He's been implying that he will use armed forces to repress protests and just like regular crime, which would be, I mean, considering the experience of Mexico and other experience in Latin America, it doesn't sound like a great idea. But so far, he has not done much than just claiming that he will do it. I mean, it could be worse. He could just go and do it. But it also creates this atmosphere you know, of legitimation of political repression, right? Which might come at some point. And I think that's one of the questions that we should address.
There was a recent 12-hour general strike called by Argentina's labor unions. It was really one of the most significant signs of opposition to Milei's agenda that we've seen in Argentina since his election. What are the prospects that the opposition will rise up to prevent some of his most radical ideas from coming to pass?
So I think that it was a very important expression of discontent. We need to be careful. The people who, you know, participated in the strike and the people who participated in the huge, massive demonstration that took place last week were the people that were already against him, right? So we need to be careful that we should not buy our own narrative. And I think that you will see a significant challenge to Milei's government once the people that voted for him start feeling the discontent or start feeling, disappointed, if you want. So whenever prices get too high or salaries go too low, then you will have to see people that cannot pay for their, you know, health insurance, people that cannot buy books for their kids at school, that will not be able to get, you know, new clothes, whatever, like, basic needs that people need to deal with, or even food. That's when you're going to see a huge crisis. Right now, when it comes to unions and when it comes to left-wing or sort of central-left-wing political parties, I think what they are focusing on is trying to stop the most long-term damaging measures that he's trying to implement. And I would say those are mainly the privatization of public companies like the oil company and the dollarization of the economy, which could be a disaster for Argentina right now.
That was Pablo Priluca, a doctoral candidate in the Department of History at Princeton University. Find more commentary on Argentina's economic and political crises by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WREK in Atlanta, Georgia, KKFI in Kansas City, Missouri, KMRE in Bellingham, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikota. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.